She was only confiding in me what no one else had the courage to say. "It ought to be enough," I said. But I feared it wouldn't.
"We'll call the new baby Virginia. Ginny, for short,"
Tom said. And I didn't gainsay him because I felt his disappointment. A son could help in the fields, but a daughter was another mouth to feed and another bride to dower. He had 4 daughters, a plantation deeply in debt and failed crops. And so, at a time when I ought to have been filled with joy for the beautiful new daughter in my arms, I was still sick with worry. That is, until the day came that I realized I couldn't afford to be sick with worry. It started with a cough. First Sally's children, then my sister's child, then mine. The illness spread so quickly that our flight from Monticello in the autumn came too late. "It's the whooping cough," Polly insisted, wringing her tiny hands. "I'd know that sound anywhere." She'd been young when she'd taken the cough at Eppington, but she hadn't forgotten. She'd survived the illness, but our little sister Lucy hadn't. And at the memory, Polly's eyes filled with tears. What could I say to comfort her or myself when our children fell ill one by one? My clever 5-year-old Ellen, after composing her very first letter to her grandfather, promptly fell into a fever and slowly began to strangle with the rest. The children were afflicted with coughing fits that made their eyes bulge, their ribs ache, and their throats so raw they sometimes vomited blood and sobbed. My newborn baby turned blue in the face and gasped for breath. My Ellen and Cornelia both cuddled together under the last clean, dry blanket I had. In her delirium, Cornelia laughed and sang to some unseen spirit above her. But Ellen had the good sense to be gloomy and terrified by her own hallucinations. "My God, they are dying," Tom whispered when I passed him in the doorway to the nursery to fetch some honeyed water for the little ones to sip. Unwilling to credit his whisper, I asked, "Would you do me the favor of fetching my cloak? The blankets and linens I washed aren't dry yet, but I can keep the girls warm and covered with my cloak." Tom took a deep, shuddering breath, then dropped his face into his hands. "We're going to lose them. Our precious baby girls." "We can't think it," I said, almost as weary as I was terrified. Then, edging past him, I hurried down the stairs and into the kitchen to scrape the last of our honey from its jar. Tom was right behind me, his big frame all a-tremble, and he spoke in a panicked whisper.
"I can't think of anything else, Patsy. I dreamed it last night. Little coffins."
How was I to hear such a thing and not sink to my knees? But I couldn't sink to my knees because our precious children needed me. "Please, Tom, please stop."
"It's my curse, Patsy. Everything I do goes wrong. Everything I make withers away. Now my daughters,"
he cried, grabbing hold of my shoulder and sobbing into my hair. "My daughters." He was so strong, so hardened from horse riding and laboring in the fields that I couldn't push him away if I tried. It wasn't as if I didn't want to cling to him, that I didn't want to offer him solace and receive it in return. But in his state, I knew Tom couldn't help himself or me. Stroking his hair, I called to my son, "Jeff, fetch my cloak for the girls." A moment later, Jeff came into the kitchen.
"They'll only spit up on your cloak. Why not?"
His eyes widened at the sight of his father weeping in my arms. And Tom roared in a sudden rage that burned away all his tears like a brush fire.
"Don't you backtalk your mother!"
Then my husband's long arm snapped out, and a slap sent our boy reeling back, stumbling for balance. "Tom!" I cried, half in disbelief as he tore himself away from me and grabbed up our boy by the shirt, pushing him against the wall. I couldn't guess what had turned his mood so swiftly, but my voice came sharp like the crack of a musket. "Tom!" My husband never laid a violent hand on our daughters, never seemed to take anything but delight in Anne, who cowered in the doorway at the edge of tears. But Jeff worked my husband's every last nerve. I suspected this time it was simply that Tom couldn't bear the thought that his son had seen him weep. He stood there, his chest heaving as he glowered at the scared little boy, then let him go with a shove.
"Go do as your mother told you."
With a hand to his stinging red cheek, Jeff ran off for my cloak, and I turned to Anne. "Your father is tired. Won't you take him into the other room and read him one of the little newspaper stories Grandpapa cut out of the paper for you?" Pretty Anne bobbed her head in obedience with a little hiccup before leading Tom out. And I was glad he went with her, even if half in a daze. For I was half in a daze myself. I turned back to my pitcher of honeyed water and stirred the honey into it, catching a glimpse of myself in the surface of the water once it stilled. Then I took a deep breath as something snapped inside me. I'd told myself that Tom would one day recover from the blow of his father's death and rejection, just as my father had come through his madness, that given enough love and time, my husband would stand up like the man he wanted to be, and I could lean on him in times of trouble. Now, I knew better. I could never, ever lean on him or my sister or anyone else. I hadn't chosen a life in which I might be cared for and pampered. I'd chosen a different path. And I ought to be grateful to Tom, I told myself, for having obliged me to exert all the strength and energy I had at my disposal. Because in this exercise, the mind acquires strength to bear up against evils that would otherwise overcome it. Realizing it, my aches and pains and ailments melted away, to leave me in more perfect health than I had enjoyed in years. For if I wanted to hold my family together, if I wanted my children to survive, I could neither be tired nor ill. If I wanted to carve out anything for myself or anyone I loved, I couldn't lean or waver. I'd have to be the pillar to hold it all up, if only because I was Thomas Jefferson's daughter. Washington, 18 April, 1802. From Thomas Jefferson to Robert R. Livingston. The cession of Louisiana by Spain to France will form a new epoch in our political course. Of all nations, France is our natural friend. Her growth we viewed as our own, her misfortunes ours. But it's impossible that France and the U.S. can continue long friends when they meet in so irritable a position as they do now. The day France takes possession of New Orleans, we must marry ourselves to the British fleet and nation. My father was not, as the Federalists suggested, blind to the dangers of Napoleon. Rather, I believe it was his well-known sympathy for France that made possible, in a way it wouldn't have been possible for any other president, the successful purchase of Louisiana. Even before it was completed in the third year of his presidency, it was plain that the Louisiana purchase would be one of his greatest achievements, a staggering success of careful and opportunistic statecraft that doubled the size of the country. And the Federalists could scarcely mount up an opposition to it. My father's political victory had been a bloodless revolution, we said. But there had been blood, Hamilton's blood, spilled from the body of his eldest son in defense of his honor. One of my father's supporters had claimed Mr. Hamilton intended to overthrow the government to stop a Jeffersonian presidency. That claim now proven utterly untrue, Philip Hamilton confronted his father's accuser in a duel and was shot dead. It was a reminder to me that public life could be fatal, exerting a toll on families that was difficult to underestimate. So my husband couldn't have astonished me more if he'd grown a horn in the middle of his head when, before the purchase of Louisiana was negotiated, he said,
"Jack Epps is running for Congress. I'm going to do the same."
My sister's husband was running in a newly created district where his chances of victory were good. The seat Tom wanted was already occupied by one of my father's strongest supporters. If Tom lost, it'd not only alienate the man against my father, but would also crush my husband utterly. And even if Tom won, they'd say he hadn't earned his seat in Congress on his own merits, but on my father's name. For both of Jefferson's son-in-laws to run together was to invite rumor of a Jeffersonian dynasty. But when Tom told me, there was an earnest pride and eagerness in his expression, one I hadn't seen since he was a boy, gazing up at my father with admiration. I realized what it would mean to him to win a seat in Congress, what it would mean to him to succeed. Tom had never wanted to be a planter. His responsibilities as a father and a husband had probably put a legal career out of reach forever. But he didn't need that to serve in Congress. I didn't know how we'd manage the plantations without Tom or my father, but I didn't have the heart to discourage my husband. I simply didn't have the heart. "Why, I think it's a wonderful idea, Tom." He embraced me, planting 1,000 kisses on my cheeks.
"What a lucky man I am to have you for a wife," he said, holding my face in his hands. "Don't you worry about the farms. I have a plan."
I was worried. If Tom won, he'd be absent from home, just as my father was perpetually absent. Our already shaky fortunes would suffer. I wasn't worried about Monticello. In Papa's absence, the Hemmings family ran everything there from the blacksmith's shop to the dairy. We only needed to send an overseer there once a week. But the outlying farms. Slaves could do the planting, but the operations would need to be overseen every day, and I doubted we could recoup the expense of a more permanent overseer. Though I'd found more strength in me than I knew I had while nursing my entire family back to health through the whooping cough and managing a household besides, I feared that along with the children and the house and the outbuildings, the responsibility for the farms and the crops would now fall to me, and that I might not prove worthy of the challenge. So I girded myself for his answer. "What plan?"
"Cotton,"
Tom said, as he began to describe his scheme.
"It's like printing money, it's so profitable."
This confused me utterly. I hadn't thought cotton a profitable crop in Virginia. He nodded.
"That's why I'm going to Georgia. I thought originally to try the Mississippi Territory, but every white man there is outnumbered by slaves and dangerous Indians. So I'm going to purchase land in Georgia."
The blood drained from my face. It was, of course, a husband's prerogative to decide where his family would go. But if Tom thought I'd submit to dragging our children into parts hitherto unknown, he'd misjudged me thoroughly. My voice actually quavered when I asked, "You want to pack up and move to Georgia?" He stroked my hair.
"No, no, of course not. I can't hold a congressional seat in Virginia if we make a home in Georgia, can I? No, I'll go to Georgia to prospect land, and when I find a good place, I'll establish all our Negroes there.
My horrified expression must not have changed a whit, because he quickly added,
I know you're worried about our people, Patsy. I have nothing but the deepest concern for those whose happiness fortune has thrown upon our will. We won't break up any families. We'll send them all together. I promise you, the culture of cotton is the least laborious of any ever practiced. It's a gentle labor.
Maybe. But what about domestic servants? Even if I could part with them, I couldn't bear to see them sent away in fear. They'll be terrified, Tom.
We'll have to ease them into it, he agreed. We'll have to tell them that we're all going. My slaves are willing to accompany me anywhere, but their attachment to you would make their departure very heavy unless they believed you were to follow soon.
No wonder my husband never liked deception. Even when he could muster up the stomach for a lie, he had no talent for it. There was no earthly way we could fool our domestic servants, who watched our every move and listened to our every word. And if our domestic servants knew we weren't going with them to Georgia, our field hands would soon learn it too, at which point the entire thing would be completely unmanageable. Which is why I agreed to do it. I knew it would never work. Like every other wild-eyed scheme of easy fortune I'd ever heard, this one would require a sharp focus that my husband could never bring to bear while campaigning for a seat in Congress. A campaign he'd decidedly lose, after which maybe we could get back to the sensible business of paying off the debts on farms he already owned. In the end, I was half right. Tom's interest in cotton came to nothing. He never even made the trip to Georgia. But he and Jack both won a seat in Congress. Jack by a landslide, my husband by 13 votes. And I was now the daughter of the president and the wife of a congressman.
Chapter 26 Monticello, 12 August, 1802. From Thomas Jefferson to William Short.
Will you not come and pass the months of August and September with us at Monticello? Make this place your home while I am here. You will find none more healthy, none so convenient for your affairs, and certainly none where you will be so cordially welcome.
This isn't the first time I've found William's name while thumbing through my father's papers. Not even the first time I've traced the lettering of his name with a bittersweet ache. Since our break in Paris, William continued to exchange letters with my father, though Papa was always prudent enough not to speak of them to me beyond the occasional Mr. Short sends his regards. At the time, it had seemed perfectly natural that William would, upon finally returning to America, call upon his mentor. But I never knew, until finding this letter, that it was my father's invitation that brought William back into my life. And now that my father is dead, I'm left to wonder why. That summer, my father came to Edgehill to fetch me in a fine carriage pulled by even finer horses. At the sound of wheels grinding up the road, I came flying out of the house, my daughters behind me, squealing with glee to see the kindly grandfather who sent them books and poems and other treats with every packet. My children all loved him, and he loved each of them in return. And I nearly envied my children the sweet, playful side Papa always showed them. If I were to tell them that he'd once been a stony and remote father with exacting standards, they'd scarcely believe me. Why, watching him play the royal game of goose with my children as we loaded up the carriage, I could scarcely believe it myself. And I'd lived it.
This visit is going to restore our spirits, Martha,
Papa said, boldly placing a smooch on my cheek when we were ready to leave. How I basked in his love and affection. Tom and Jeff would follow our caravan on horseback, but I climbed into the carriage with my father. As the wheels rattled on, I said, I'm relieved to see you've somehow come home without your presidential entourage. I hope we won't have many visitors this summer.
Just the Madisons.
My father bounced little Jenny on his knee with genuine delight.
And one special visitor we've been waiting to see for a very long time. Mr. Short.
It had been nearly 13 years since I left William Short in Paris. 13 years. In that time, I'd taught myself to forget him. But when Papa told me that he was to visit with us, my practiced indifference unraveled, and I couldn't decide if it was a blessing or a curse that my husband knew nothing about my anxieties at this reunion. One evening, Tom asked,
So this Mr. Short, was he one of your suitors in Paris?
I'd just finished playing the harpsichord for the Madisons, and my fingers froze over the keys, unable to make my tongue move an answer. Fortunately, Papa rescued me by saying,
Oh, Patsy had a gaggle of suitors in Paris. Even the son of the Duke, I seem to recall.
I smiled gratefully at my father, but Mr. Madison's face pinched in a sour disapproval, far more affecting than it ought to have been from such a tiny little man.
Mr. Short has had a very storied career.
Madison's wife, whom everyone was encouraged to call Dolly, put her delicate hand on his arm and laughed until the careless plume with which she'd ornamented her hair shook with merriment.
They do say Mr. Short has a way with money, and he's done the country a great service.
Then her eyes twinkled with the promise of juicy gossip.
But I've heard notorious stories about him living in open congress with his lover, a French harlot at that.
Tom's eyes widened. My father winced. I did not. The Duchess Rosalie is no harlot.
Oh, you knew her?
Dolly asked me, leaning forward with rosy pink cheeks that matched the satin of her gown.
I suppose you're quite right to hold her blameless. It's Mr. Short who hasn't made an honest woman of her. He's allowed himself to be debauched away from the morals of his countrymen. I dare say, in returning to America, he's likely found himself in another world. It's good that he isn't returning with the Duchess on his arm, or the stain on his honor would be more difficult to wash out.
As painfully shy and withdrawn as my sister had become, this prompted her to break in with,
Perhaps we ought not judge them too harshly. I remember Mr. Short very kindly from our time in Paris.
Well, you would, you sweet dear, Dolly said. You give us all a good example to follow. We must be very kind to Mr. Short, for I fear our neighbors won't be so forgiving.
What I feared was that William wouldn't be forgiving. Had he ever forgiven me? I still had Marie's letter, the one that said how angrily he'd denied loving me. I wondered if he was angry still. And I wondered, too, how he might look now, at the age of 43. I hoped he'd grown bald and portly. Certainly he wouldn't be as handsome as my own husband, whose beauty had only sharpened with years. I was to find out for myself at the start of August, when William arrived in a carriage even more splendid than the President's, with scarlet velvet curtains and gilt trim on the doors, driven by matching black horses with red plumes. For a moment, watching William step down from the coach, I was transported in time and place. Paris, before the Revolution, when such carriages went every day to and from Versailles. And when William flashed a grin, I could see to my great disappointment that he hadn't grown soft or bald or portly. Nor did he even look as if he'd aged. His facial features remained boyish, even if there was a hint of silver in his sandy hair. In an embroidered blue tailcoat, a dangling gold watch fob, a newly fashionable top hat and breeches tucked into tall riding boots, he gave every impression of a dignified courtier and man of importance. It was suddenly easy to imagine people calling him His Excellency Mr. Short, the Minister of the United States of America. All the more when he stepped forward to greet my father and executed a very correct bow.
"Mr. President," William said, as if the words gave him delight and satisfaction to speak aloud.
At their long-awaited reunion, my father pulled into an embrace with the man he'd once considered his adoptive son, patting his back with so much vigor and affection that I thought I might weep. The two men who had been most important to me in my youth held each other by the arms, taking stock of one another after more than a decade, laughing at the joy of it. William said,
"President Jefferson, from the harbor all the way here, I've heard nothing but joyous thanksgiving. You're very much in the public favor, sir."
With his arms about William's shoulder, my father replied,
"I fear more confidence has been placed in me than my qualifications merit. I dread the disappointment of my friends." "Never that,"
William replied, even though in his case I knew it to be a polite lie. Though he tried to disguise it, his eyes swept uncomfortably to the servants who ran forward to fetch his bags and water the horses. There was no mistaking his loathing of slavery, but it wasn't in his nature to criticize his host. He was, after all, still a Virginian. Diplomacy ruled him. And it's because I knew that he was a diplomat, well practiced with words, that I startled when he lifted his green eyes to mine and said, in French,
"Vous êtes une vision angélique, Madame Randolph."
These were the first words we'd spoken to one another after 13 years and an ocean of silence. I'd expected some tightness at the mouth that might hint of pain or regret. Instead, he'd made his eyes twinkle while comparing me to an angel of all things. Did he mean for his words to cut? Perhaps I'd been so eclipsed in his life and in his heart that he didn't even remember he'd once pointedly praised me, not as an angel, but an Amazon. And I was suddenly swamped by the memory of that day, when he confessed to having stolen a lock of my hair to keep as a token, a memory so bittersweet that it was hard to speak the words, "Welcome home, Mr. Short." But I said it, and then it was done. The moment that had filled me with dread and anticipation was simply over, as if it were of no significance, not even attended by the awkwardness that might have made it of some comforting consequence. Instead, the awkwardness belonged to Sally Hemings. Seeing her on the portico with her two light-skinned, blue-eyed, freckled children clinging to her skirts, William made an elaborate and courtly bow.
"What a delight to see you again, madame."
We all froze in an awkward tableau, for William had acknowledged my father's slave mistress with a courtesy title, one accorded ladies or women whose marital status was unknown, as one might do in France when openly acknowledging a man's mistress. At Monticello, my father kept quiet his relationship with Sally, such that even my children seemed unaware of it. But, of course, William had been there when it started. Thankfully, Sally was quick to bob an exaggerated curtsy like a French courtier, then adopted the strange sliding gait we'd all practiced at Versailles. "Monsieur." Her antics broke the tension and allowed everyone to laugh. But I was unsteadied enough to miss a step going into the house. Tom noticed, catching me by the elbow and hugging me against his side with the fit of good humor that had struck him since his election to Congress.
"It seems Mr. Short will be amiable company,"
Tom said, oblivious to the storm of emotions inside me.
"The children certainly like him."
Ahead of us, my little cherubs all danced around William, who had a bag of half-melted chocolate drops for them. Chocolate drops. Another reminder for me, or simply a gift for the children. And why should it bother me that I didn't know? I was over-aware of William every single day he spent with us that hottest of summer months. I tried desperately to stay away, but the sound of his laughter carried to me through the house wherever I went. I seemed to sense him even before he passed by the doorway of the blue sitting room where I taught my children. I knew when he took his seat at the supper table beside my father, before even turning to see. And that is how, without even having to look up, I knew it was he who had come upon me in my father's garden that day.
"I think you're avoiding me, Mrs. Randolph,"
William said, bareheaded, shielding his eyes against the sun. "I think I'm harvesting the garden, Mr. Short," I said from beneath the shadow of my straw hat, fretting that he should come upon me in my house dress, my hands covered in dirt. A Virginia gentleman would have pretended not to see the lady of the house hard at work, even if the garden was her sweet escape from the demands of everyone inside the house. A Virginia gentleman would have passed by without a word and waited to address me in polite company. But perhaps the code of Virginia gentlemen no longer applied to William Short.
"Not growing Indian corn this year?"
he asked. I plucked a squash for my basket, too nervous to do more than glance at him. "Are you missing it?"
"I've missed many things from Virginia," he said, moving with gallantry to take the basket from me.
Feeling as if I must surrender it to him, I said, "You've been gone a very long time."
17 years. Partly in service to my country, partly for powerfully personal reasons.
I had no right whatsoever to ask about those powerfully personal reasons, and I was determined to say nothing of his duchess. "You must find everything much changed." His eyes fell upon our enslaved gardener, Wormley Hughes, working with spade and hoe at the far end of the rows, and he frowned.
"Some things not enough changed."
Then William turned his gaze to me.
"And other things changed nearly beyond my comprehension. I dare say your friends in France won't believe me when I tell them the girl who ran through the convent with her petticoats in the dirt is now a reserved and nurturing mother of five."
He walked with me as I worked down a row. "Six if you count Tom's little sister Jenny, and I always do. Of course, she's of marriageable age now, and so very pretty I don't doubt she'll have her choice of suitors." I rambled, unable to stop myself. "I'll have to write more to Marie and my French friends, the ones who I still have a way of finding. We've been very afraid for them since the revolution."
His posture stiffened. "With good reason. I'm afraid your father was entirely too optimistic about the happenings in France. But I suppose it's difficult for anyone who wasn't there to imagine the horrors that have unfolded."
"I thank God Lafayette has finally been released. Papa says it was your doing."
"I wish that were true. Thank Monroe and Morris, I was merely a go-between, but I'm happy for Lafayette. And I wish others had been as fortunate.
Then I knew that I must say something about his Duchess, if only because it was beyond the bounds of decency not to. Please know that it pained us to learn what befell the Duc de La Rochefoucauld during the September massacres. My heart suffered for Rosalie to become a widow in such a tragic way. When you see her next, please convey my deepest sympathies and my hopes for her happiness.
William stared, as if doubting my words. But there was no artifice in what I'd said. Though I harbored jealousy for Rosalie, I could never wish her unhappy, or him. At length, William must have seen the sincerity in my eyes, because he said, "If I see Rosalie again, I'll give her your message."
"If you see her again?" I asked, unwisely, rashly. At my question, his gaze slid away.
"She and I have come to a crossroads. 3 times I asked her to marry me, and 3 times she's refused. At first, in respect to her husband's memory, then because she couldn't leave Madame d'Anville to the mercy of the Jacobins, and finally, because she'd rather be the Dowager Duchess de La Rochefoucauld in blood-soaked France than simply Mrs. William Short anywhere else."
I sensed more bitterness than truth. "You can't mean that."
"I'm perhaps being unjust to Rosalie. It's simply been my misfortune to fall under the spell of women whose loyalties to family and country cannot be shaken by my love."
My mouth went dry at this very soft but very earnest remonstration. I thought to offer some apology, some explanation that might undo the pain I'd caused him in leaving France. "Oh, William."
"Please don't," he said, cutting me off.
By using his given name, I'd abandoned the propriety and formality without which our conversation might be a guilty thing, an offense to my husband and my father both. And it seemed more than he could bear.
"It's the fate of diplomats, a natural hazard of foreign service. But, as I said, Rosalie and I have come to a crossroads. Your father has made plain to me that we cannot go on as we have been."
"My father?" I couldn't imagine Papa in frank discussion about, well, almost anything, but certainly not matters such as illicit mistresses. William nodded.
"When your father was elected president, I hoped at long last to secure the position as minister to France that I've coveted. Your father, however, informed me that such an appointment is now quite impossible, for I've been too long absent from our country to represent its sentiments. So I've come home."
He was wounded. I could see that. Nor could I blame him. Though I was certain my father had good reasons, the result struck me as profoundly unjust. William had spent the better part of nearly 2 decades toiling for his country overseas, sometimes in dangerous places, deftly securing our nation's credit, making endless intelligence reports to better our position and save us from war. For it to be implied to such a man that he was somehow not enough American to represent his country, William must have seen it as the grossest ingratitude. I wished that I could think how to soothe his hurt feelings, but instead I asked, "How long will you stay in America?" He shifted the basket between his hands and looked again across the garden.
"Until a solution presents itself. There are apparently those who disapprove of my conduct in France, and will thwart my appointment to any diplomatic post."
William could win them over, I thought. He was as charming as he'd ever been, more charming, I thought, when he finally reached for a vine to help me with my forgotten harvest, and said,
"I've much mending offenses to do in Virginia, where it seems I've been replaced entirely."
Wary of his closeness, I wondered if he knew that there'd been a small secret place in my heart that I'd always kept for him. I loved my husband, but Tom had never taken William's place up entirely. "No one could replace you."
His eyes twinkled with amused outrage, and he lowered his voice to an intimate whisper. "The young and heroic Meriwether Lewis certainly has. Your father dotes on his new secretary with a fatherly affection I once believed he reserved only for me."
I'd caused the breach between my father and William. Still, his jest snipped the tension. I began to laugh. Then we laughed together. "Meriwether Lewis is no William Short," I declared. My father had always cultivated an endless stream of protégés, but William had been the first and best of them. For unlike the others, he had a most personal acquaintance with my father's faults, and was devoted to him anyway. Even having been snubbed for the appointment that would have crowned his career, and maybe even won over his lady to marriage, still here he was, paying homage to my father at Monticello. "I don't believe you ever need worry of being replaced, William. Papa always says that those we loved first are those we love best." William smiled very softly then, in a way I hoped meant that we could still be friends.
"Come, Patsy, you're getting pink. Let's take some shade in one of your father's porticos."
"We're likely to trip over a workman's hammer and come away covered in plaster dust," I protested, since Monticello's renovations were endless.
"Here, then," he said, guiding me under the sheltering leaves of a cherry tree at the far end of the garden and setting down the basket by my feet.
He offered his forearm to help me lower to a seat against the trunk, which I took with as much elegance as my house dress and apron would allow. "So what will you do until some foreign post is offered?" I asked. He took a seat beside me but angled away, so that no one who might come upon us could think it an impropriety. With our backs to the trees, side by side, I couldn't see his face, but only his hands as he plucked a blade of grass and rolled it between his clean, elegant fingers.
"I suppose I must find somewhere to live. Some years ago, I prevailed upon your father to manage my investments while I was away. With that money, he purchased for me some land called Indian Camp. Very fertile, he says. Very advantageous lands here in Albemarle County."
Here in Albemarle, where we might be neighbors. Yet I couldn't let myself hope for it, not even for a moment, because I saw his hands reach to pluck up more grass, this time violently. And I remembered what he'd said in the heat of anger when we argued in Paris, that Virginia is stained in the evil of slavery, impossible debts and a way of life that can't last. "But you don't care to make a home at Indian Camp." He crossed his legs at the ankle, so that the steel buckle of his shoe glinted in the light.
"I suggested to Mr. Jefferson an experiment of sorts, that he should rent out my Indian Camp property to tenant farmers. Part of the acreage to free white men, part to free black men, as an experiment."
"An experiment?"
"I hope to prove something to him about the potential for emancipation," he said, watching some of the slave children play with my own little ones on the lawn.
Amongst those children was Sally's pretty Harriet. And William swallowed.
"Consider, for example, the perfect mixture of the rose and the lily. I've suggested to your father, too, that the mixture of the races is our surest path to doing away with racial prejudice. but his unwillingness to pursue my experiment at Indian Camp, nor even acknowledge my argument, tells me that an honorable life cannot be made in Virginia. Because if a man in your father's singular situation cannot do it, if an icon of liberty cannot do it, I must conclude it cannot be done here at all.
I blinked into the sun, then blinked again. William had always favored the abolition of slavery, but what he spoke of now went far beyond the sentiments of even the most adventurous thinker on the matter I had ever met. I could not think his mention of my father's singular situation with regard to race mixing was an accidental mention. But I wasn't a naive girl any longer who could muse on such matters with impunity, and he should have understood that our southern silence about the color line wasn't one I'd break even for him. "So you'll sell Indian Camp? Can you afford to?" A breeze blew, and his hands let loose the grass which floated away.
"I can afford a great many things now, Patsy. Even excluding the value of Indian Camp and my lands in Kentucky, not to mention the sums still outstanding from the State Department, I estimate my fortune at nearly $100,000.
It was a very large sum. So large, in fact, that I went numb from the tip of my nose down to my tongue, and sat there stunned like a felled ox. At my silence, he continued,
"It's ill-mannered to speak of money in the presence of ladies. But I bring it up to set your mind at ease about the loan I've made to your father. I don't want him to feel honor-bound to repay it, when I can see plainly that his fortunes have fallen here."
I took instant umbrage, and would have objected that of course the state of Reconstruction only made it look as if my father's fortunes had fallen, but I was too stunned by something else he'd said. "You made a loan to my father?" How had it come to pass that the man my father had once lectured about gold not falling from the sky had come to be our creditor? In soft tones that somehow still assaulted my disbelieving ears, he explained,
I'm so sorry. I was sure you knew. Yes, I made a loan for his nail factory here at Monticello, and a flour mill. But personal exigencies have prevented him from repaying the loan with what profits he has taken from those enterprises.
I could guess at the personal exigencies that occasioned my father's inability to pay. Papa had advanced money to my husband to pay the mortgage on Verena, had divided up his properties to make another gift to keep us with a roof over our heads. All along, I'd been so very grateful to my father for saving us from ruin, never suspecting Mr. Short was our savior. William Short, who had somehow accumulated a fortune without putting his shovel in the dirt. Though it was unladylike for me to ask, improper in every way, William had been the only person to whom I'd ever spoken in frankness, and 13 years of separation didn't change this. How much does he owe you? Though I'd wager he knew the exact sum down to the cent, he said,
"Somewhere in the order of $15,000. I've offered to forgive the debt entirely, but your father won't hear of it. So I must rely upon you to persuade him not to let pride be the cause of his impoverishment."
"I've no knowledge or involvement in my father's finances," I said, which was only the proper way of it, but somehow, in light of this man's expectations of me, felt like a shameful confession. "He never speaks of them to me."
William nodded. "Nevertheless, I have no other avenue of appeal, because no one has more power or influence over the president than you do."
I wondered if I ought to feel flattered or terrified to believe it.
It was a fact that my bond with my father was strong enough that even sometimes Polly complained of it, gently accusing Papa of loving me better. And though only Sally Hemings was allowed to freely roam his private chambers, whenever he returned from the capital, he didn't race back to Sally. He came straight away to Edgehill to get me.
You're too kind, William, both to my father and to me.
I would be kinder if I could, was his reply.
Then, after a few moments of silence, he added,
Your children are wonderful.
William breathed in sharply, then snapped off his succinct evaluation.
Jeff seems a very robust little fellow. Anne and baby Jenny are sweet enough to rot teeth. Your Ellen is very clever.
But I see the essence of you in Cornelia's eyes. That little girl isn't all she seems to be. I smiled. I'm afraid I've become exactly what I seem to be.
He gave a dubious laugh. And I'm afraid that I have become an old bachelor, with nothing to show for my efforts but the adoration of other men's children. I suppose I'll have to take more of an interest in my nephews.
With a comedic sigh that in no way disguised the seriousness, he added,
In the meantime, I suppose I must now leave you to your gardening and sow seeds of my own. We dine with Mr. Madison tonight, and as your father has made plain to me, I must reacquaint myself with our countrymen.
I must reacquaint myself with our countrymen.
William had said this lightly, but at supper that night, it became manifestly evident that my father wasn't wrong to have insisted upon it. The unique situation of my father's house being unfinished, the expense of the redesign project Papa had conceived upon our return from Paris, combined with his frequent absences to make the rebuilding of a large portion of Monticello an unending affair, led to an informality that permitted women to remain in the dining room after the men began to drink, and I was present to witness an argument. It began amiably enough, with the Virginia gentlemen all sipping wine and peppering William with questions about Europe. They wanted to know especially of Napoleon Bonaparte, the new First Consul of France, which now modeled itself even more closely after ancient Rome. William harbored some admiration for the sense of order restored by Bonaparte, but warned against embracing the brilliant revolutionary general, given his hunger for power. This quickly turned into a disagreement about the nature of French diplomacy, pitting Mr. Short's cynicism about French revolutionaries against Mr. Madison's faith in their good intentions, leaving Madison to simmer like a teapot, growing more florid by the moment. The conversation went from bad to worse when the subject turned to finances. My father and Mr. Short agreed that the James River Canal Company was an opportunity for profitable investment. I confess I was distracted in that moment, scolding Jeff for running past the tables, so all I caught was Mr. Short making the wry remark, No doubt the Virginia legislature will attack the canal company as soon as the dividends begin to excite envy. A scandalized silence followed until Jack Epps cried, An outrageous accusation! My husband, thankfully, only set down his glass.
Why ever would you say such a thing, Mr. Short?
Mr. Madison accused, because he's thrown in with the stock jobbers and paper men. It was so chilly a remark, filled with such disdain, that it couldn't be dispelled by the thin smile that followed. Good Southern Republicans were planters. Northern Federalists were stock jobbers and paper men. Virginians were suffering financially, suffering badly, but William had profited. I understood the unspoken assessment of the Secretary of State, my father's closest political friend and ally. Madison was saying that William Short wasn't one of us anymore. Though William ignored the insult and quickly steered the conversation to more pleasant topics, I worried for his reputation, not to mention his future as a diplomat at Mr. Madison's Department of State. And I worried for the disruption of our domestic tranquility when Tom was still brooding about the discussion that evening. As we checked on the children in the nursery, he murmured, "This country is so divided." "Yes," I said, though a part of me wondered if it was ever thus.
"Mr. Madison and Mr. Short, they're accomplished men, lawyers. Jack fits with them better than I do. I feel like the proverbially silly bird who can't feel at ease amongst the swans."
Had I somehow betrayed my feelings for William in a way that brought Tom's insecurities about? Lacing my fingers with his, I said, "You really are a silly bird if you think Jack Epps is better than you in any way at all. You're more thoughtful than he is, and the country needs men like you, Congressman Randolph. My father needs you." I did mean that, even though the thought was eclipsed the next day when I came across the strangely nostalgic scene of William Short in the hallway, lurking near Papa's door like he used to in my father's times of trouble. In his hand, he held folded pages, newsprint upon his fingers. Another man, any other man, would have told me it wasn't fit for ladies to read. But William merely reddened, saying,
"You need to see this, Patsy, though you won't thank me for showing you."
Chapter 27. The Richmond Recorder. 1st of September, 1802.
It is well known that the man whom it delights the people to honor keeps, and for many years past has kept as his concubine, one of his own slaves. Her name is Sally. The name of her eldest son is Tom. His features are said to bear a striking, although sable, resemblance to those of the president himself. The boy is 10 or 12 years of age. His mother went to France in the same vessel with Mr. Jefferson and his two daughters. The delicacy of this arrangement must strike every person of common sensibility. What a sublime example for an American ambassador to place before the eyes of two young ladies.
Papa kept this clipping. It's here in his wooden filing presses, amidst his belongings, as if it were no more than a passing memorandum, or a recipe, or a scrap of poem, and not a devastating exposure that set the political world aflame. It was also a betrayal, written by James Callender, one of my father's partisans turned odious blackmailer. So I burn this clipping, even knowing there are a thousand more like it in the world. And worse things were printed after it. The newspapers brought me and my sister into the scandal directly, offering sympathies for the supposed humiliations my father had visited upon us by forcing us to see illegitimate mulatto sisters and brothers enjoying the same parental affection with ourselves. They asked why Papa hadn't married a worthy woman of his own complexion. They lampooned him as a bad father, a bad owner, a bad president. But this first article, the one that William Short showed me, somehow did the most damage.
"I'm sorry, Patsy," William had said. "This is going to be a very difficult time for all of you."
My hand came to my mouth as my eyes traced over the words a second time. Anger curled inside my belly. Would the entirety of my father's presidency find him under constant attack? How could they print such a thing? He gave me a sad, sympathetic look.
because partisanship has made anything fair, which honor and propriety might once have kept quiet.
Shaking my head, I stared at him. I don't... How will we...
William looked down for a moment.